You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret White.
Terry Brooks.
Sheena Kamal.
Matthew Quick.
J.T. Ellison.
Walt D. Williams.
Brad Ford.
Corey Doctorow.
Brandon Sanderson.
Robin Mom.
Ernest Klein. Jim Butcher.
Sherwin Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is...
Nick Petrie.
Welcome to Author Stories. Find archives of all the shows at HankGarner.com, and while you're there, never miss an episode by subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and YouTube. It's free on all platforms. As we get into today's show, I'd like to tell you guys about some incredible new releases that I know you're going to love. The brand new book from Nathan Heistad, Rift, The Resistance, Book 1. They've watched us for centuries through the Rift. They prepared. Invasion is inevitable. The Earth fleet has known of the Watchers for years, unwilling to share the knowledge with humanity. Now it might be too late. Hidden away from the fleet, one man is creating a new colony ship destined for the other side of the Rift, but he's missing a few pieces. Three other people have varied paths to get there. Ace goes from the streets of Earth to the fleet training facility on the moon. Flint, an ex-fleet pilot, must decide if a job is worth his life. And Wren, imprisoned for a secret project years ago, is given hope as an unlikely ally, whispers words of escape in her ear. Their journeys lead to Councilman Jardin Fairbanks, who knows of the impending invasion and has prepared. All they can do is wait for the rift to open once again and see what's on the other side. Rift joins an ensemble cast facing immeasurable obstacles. If you enjoy space battles, prison breaks, androids, and aliens, buried under a shroud of mystery, this book is for you. Try it today. A fresh new fiction adventure from the author of the best-selling Survivor series, Rift, The Resistance, Book 1. Now available. There's a link in the show notes. Also from our friend Rick Partlow, Recon, A War of the Knife. Tyler Callis had a life most people would kill for. He killed to escape it. Tyler is the pampered heir of a high-level corporate council executive, groomed from birth to take a seat beside her as a member of the ruling class of the Commonwealth Society. But the bloody war with the alien Tani has hit close to home, and Tyler wants to join the military, something his powerful mother won't allow. Desperate to escape her control, Tyler changes his identity to Randall Monroe, a product of the poverty-stricken underground, and enlists in the Marines. There he flourishes, becoming a member of an elite force recon unit and striking deep behind enemy lines. But when his platoon is assigned to take back the colony on Demeter from the Tani, the mission falls apart. Most of his comrades are killed, and Monroe is wounded, separated from his unit and left for dead on an enemy-occupied world. With no other choice, he organizes the civilian colonists into a resistance movement and begins fighting against the occupation, with limited supplies and no support. As the situation becomes more and more desperate, what began as a high-tech interstellar conflict will become a war to the knife. Recon, A War to the Knife by Rick Partlow. There's a link to it in the show notes. Book 3 of the Saga of the Iron Dragon, the conclusion of the epic series that began with the Dream of the Iron Dragon. 9th century Iceland, three explorers from the far future have a daunting mission. To save humanity, they must build a craft capable of reaching the stars. The Voyage of the Iron Dragon is the concluding book in the Iron Dragon trilogy. The Iron Dragon trilogy is being produced as part of the phenomenally successful Saga of the Iron Dragon Kickstarter, which raised over $10,000. Meticulously researched and packed with action, The Dream of the Iron Dragon is a must for sci-fi and alternate history fans. Also, Book 2, The Dawn of the Iron Dragon, is available now from Audible.com. There's a link to it in the show notes. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to welcome back to the show Nick Petrie. He was on the show last year, episode 299, and we had a great time talking about his new book at the time. If you read that book, and I know you all did because we highly recommended it to everybody, you are in for a treat with the new book. Welcome back to the show, Nick.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
your last book, Light It Up, was one of the best books that I had read in quite a while. The premise is what immediately grabs you, this really unique premise of the book. And then we get to, you know, as we get past that, your fantastic character of Ash really takes over the story, and we go to another level. Tell us a little bit about Ash and kind of where he came from and where we find him in the new book.
Well, sure. Well, Peter Ash is a Marine Corps veteran, and like many of the veterans I've spoken with, he's having trouble kind of adjusting to life after his war. And I'm not a veteran myself. I'm not writing from personal experience, but I've talked with quite a few veterans now and heard about the challenges they're facing, and I was really moved by those conversations, and Peter Ash has kind of came out of that. He's a very capable guy. He's very driven, but he's also struggling with a form of post-traumatic stress that takes the form of claustrophobia. He calls it the white static. So he can't be inside for more than a few minutes. And I think it's this really human combination of traits that really seems to resonate with readers. One of the best parts about this series sort of gaining legs and broadening the audience is now veterans really reach out to me on a regular basis. So I'm hearing the stories of their struggles really still on a regular basis. And honestly, it's one of the best things about what I do is making those connections and talking to people.
The premise of the previous book, dealing with the cannabis industry, and finding a way to make a great thriller adventure story out of the circumstances of that situation. And I remember talking with you, and just my eyes were open to a lot of the logistical problems that come with being in that industry, and the fact that if you have a perfectly legal business selling cannabis, but you still can't participate in traditional banking, and so there's this need for people to guard money and all of that, and it really lends itself to a lot of underhanded dealings with the underworld, if you want to put it that way. And Peter Ash is the perfect person to insert into that kind of situation. The new book is a different kind of story in a different setting with different problems. What was the motivation for where Peter Ash finds himself this time?
Well, one of pieces of the series that I like the best is that each book takes place someplace different. And in addition to, it lets me really tell the right story in the right place. And there are a lot of positives to telling a story that takes place in the same setting. The Spencer books in Boston or the setting, you know, those forms have a certain strength, but there are only, you know, I live in Milwaukee, and there are sort of certain stories that are easier to tell in Milwaukee and certain stories that are harder. And so I wanted to be able to tell a wide range of stories with this character who's not, you know, he's not an institutional person. He's not a policeman. He's no longer in the military. And I also wanted the freedom to be able to have him sometimes be working with law enforcement, sometimes to be working against law enforcement, to be in a rural setting, in an urban setting, to, you know, tell a story on the run. It was about what kind of stories I could tell. And Memphis started out, the idea was I would tell a story that would center around an earthquake, because Memphis is the largest city in the New Madrid seismic zone, which is the site of four of the largest earthquakes in recorded American history. But Memphis is such a compelling place, and Memphis, kind of even more than other books, really rose up as a character. And the earthquake just sort of didn't happen because my character sort of, you know, what the the characteristics of Memphis, which is, has this rich and deep history, inform the characters. And the characters really didn't want to you know, be part of an earthquake. They really wanted to bang against each other in a way that the book just sort of went a whole different direction. And it was so much fun to write.
Which is a different kind of earthquake.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely some banging of my head against the wall, which is part of every writer's experience, I think.
Yeah. Well, I was happy to see that it was set in Memphis. I live about 2.5 hours south of Memphis, and it's one of the places we go to get away and do things. And you're right. It's Memphis and the South in general, but Memphis is a really unique, a town. It's right on the Mississippi River. It's a sort of a gateway, in some ways, where a lot of the slaves after the Civil War left and a lot of that, them went through Memphis to go north, and some stayed, some continued on. But it's this really interesting gumbo of people that live there. What did you find most interesting about Memphis when you started writing about there and really understanding a lot of the cultural dynamics and the earthquake of people and cultures kind of hitting head to head?
Well, it's a place that has been kind of a crossroads for centuries, because it's on the Mississippi, and it's the reason why FedEx is headquartered there now. It's a very convenient place for transshipments of all kinds, and it's also, as it turns out, a transshipment zone for illegal everything that's coming up from southern ports going up to the north. There are, the highway networks that go through there. It's a easy city to get through and to get around. So part of it was kind of that idea, but part of it is I'm someone who loves sort of rural America, and I love to be outside, and I love especially sort of the mountains and the woods. But urban areas are a whole different sort of experience, and so I really love cities too, and Memphis as a city actually shares a lot in common with my hometown in Milwaukee, which is that it's been sort of hollowed out in the center, and much of the wealth is in the surrounding suburbs. And so, kind of what is that dynamic like, and what is life like for sort of the poor Memphians, if that's what you call someone who lives in Memphis, as it turns out. What's life like for those who are still living in sort of the most ruined parts of that city? And so that's part of what I was trying to research and imagine my way into as well.
You're right about the interesting dynamic about the kind of Memphis proper as being kind of hollowed out and all the wealth going outside the city. That happens in a lot of towns where you've got this urban flight,
Absolutely. The sort of the industrial north is full of this. I mean, Milwaukee's a total Rust Belt city, and all you have to do is drive east, and you'll drive through, town after town after city after city. So it's certainly not, Memphis is an example of it. It's not the place where that's happened, for sure.
What I find interesting is in a lot of those places, the wealthy people move out of the city, but then they still go into the city to work. And that's an interesting, dynamic where you go into the city, make your money, and then take it out of the city. When things like that happen, what is left for the people that live inside the city? And you explore some of that in the book. What happens when people are left, without the rest of the community there to contribute and to help? What kind of, situation do these people find themselves in?
Well, there's a number of, sort of entry points for this. So one is that infrastructure really starts to suffer. So if you drive through, especially the very worst parts of Memphis, there are areas where you'll on a given block, you'll see, one to six houses that are really abandoned and ready to be torn down. Some of them are boarded up. Some of them are are occupied by squatters. You'll also drive down blocks where homes have been torn down, so you're seeing the slabs that are still there and the grass, you know, knee-high around them, because it's expensive to tear down houses, and Memphis as a city, you know, can't afford to do all that at once. So part of it is just sort of looking at, excuse me, the infrastructure, the built environment. But the other is that there aren't a lot of opportunities. So if you are a, if you were a city kid and you never made it through high school, there are not many opportunities, especially in this day and age. It used to be that if you made it, even if you didn't make it through high school, but if you made it through high school, you could get a job in manufacturing. You could get a job in a car plant. You could get a job in a machine shop. You could get a job in agriculture. And now it's harder and harder for people to get even those entry level jobs without a high school degree. So, you know, we don't have a system in place to you know, sort of, you know, get people plugged into the mainstream economy. And so what happens in inner cities all over the country is that people begin to participate in their own economy. And often that's an informal economy where people are paying cash for things. But also there's a criminal economy. There's the drug economy is the thing that really is one of the things that's happening in this book. The way those systems work, it was really interesting to read about kind of how those organizations are built and how they're put together and what mechanisms are put in place for them to keep themselves secure against law enforcement and against their rivals. So, you know, again, I'm always interested in how things work and reading about how those systems function. It was fascinating. And I've built some of that into this book.
I know that you love to set books in different cities, and especially when you can find a place that the city almost becomes a character, like you mentioned with Memphis. As the writer, what are the logistical challenges of getting Peter to the next place where you want a story to set? How do you move him around and give him motivation and reasons for chasing the next adventure?
Well, to your point, that you're exactly right. That for me, and not every writer who has an itinerant character that, you know, needs a reason. You know, most famous would be Lee Child's Jack Reacher, who is just sort of on the move. But it was important to me that Peter, like many people who have been in the military, Peter is sort of a mission-based person. So he's always trying to find a way to be useful in the world and trying to find something, some way to help people. And in this book, his girlfriend has a friend in Memphis who is receiving threats. Her name is Wanda Wyatt. She's actually a war correspondent. She's a photojournalist. Between the time when Peter leaves the house he shares with June, where he's not terribly comfortable because he doesn't really like to be inside, and so there's some, you know, that's a challenge as well, sort of that relationship. But so that's the catalyst that I use to get Peter to Memphis is a little bit of discord and restlessness in his relationship, and also the draw of, hey, here's somebody to help. And by the time he gets to Memphis, someone has driven a dump truck through this woman's living room, and now she really needs help. So that was part of that catalyst. But it's important to me that there be a reason. And as a writer, I mean, part of it, that's a character reason, and part of that is just a plot reason, because it's easier to start a book when you're in the middle and when something is happening. And so that's kind of my little internal trick as a way to kind of get the ball rolling. And I want things to happen in every book. I want things to start happening quickly. Was it Elmore Leonard who said start the book in the middle?
Right.
You know, without a lot of vamping around.
I love that. Speaking of Wanda, she compared Memphis to a war zone. And then our main character, Peter, deals with PTSD. And so he is thrust kind of back into a place or into a place that reminds him of all the things that he's trying to escape. When you're dealing with that kind of conflict, in a character, does that, we all know that conflict makes great stories. But when you're purposefully kind of doing to Peter what he's trying to get away from, what does that open up for you as the writer story-wise to kind of continue to torture him in this way, albeit for a good reason?
Well, I actually had a reader reach out to me not long ago who said, "Now, why are you so mean to Peter? You know, you keep putting him in all these terrible circumstances." And well, of course, that it wouldn't be a very interesting story if he just, you know, woke up and had a cup of coffee and you know, went off to work, you know, perfectly happy. So, you know, it really is a writer's job to torture his or her characters, because that's what makes interesting stories. But one of the dynamics with this book is people who are war correspondents also, who have been in those conflict zones, suffer from some of the same symptoms as the soldiers who've been there. So post-traumatic stress among photojournalists and war correspondents is a relatively commonplace thing, depending on how long they've been there and how much they've covered. And so part of this was, in addition to Peter being sort of thrown back into a situation that's not terribly dissimilar to the one he's trying to escape, we're seeing the other ways that post-traumatic stress manifests in a war correspondent on one hand, and in this young street musician named Eli Bell, who's basically been homeless since he was 9 years old and has had to bring himself up in this difficult, challenging, you know, kind of drug-ridden neighborhood. And there's a great piece on Chicago Public Radio not too long ago about how kids who grow up in dangerous neighborhoods also suffer from those same symptoms as combat veterans, because like combat veterans, there is no safe place in those neighborhoods. Like combat veterans, they see close friends injured or dead just through the course of trying to get to school and back, trying to find a job. So there are some echoes in this of sort of Peter's own story, and you know, trying to pull out other aspects of Peter in that same way.
I was with my kids. They were watching a television show that they liked, and they told me, they're like, "Dad, this character just never gets a break. It's just one thing after another, and it just, you know, goes on and on, and this, you know, she never gets a break." And I said, "Well, that's one of the great kind of tools of storytelling. Create a character that people really love, and then you know, torture them, and then allow them to have a win every now and then. But you know, you're mostly going to torture them." So you've got Peter in this situation in Memphis, and it really seems hopeless. How do you allow your character to have a win every now and then while keeping him, you know, sufficiently conflicted, and then also realizing that in a place like Memphis, in your book Tear It Down, you can bring light to a lot of the situations, but you can't solve everything in this book. How do you write a satisfying story without solving all of the problems, but allowing the character to, and for us to feel like the character has done something to change something, even if it's on a small level?
Well, I think if you wrote a book that was all about a social issue, it would really read like a polemic. It would read like a book of nonfiction. But it also wouldn't be quite as compelling. I mean, one of the beauties of fiction is that you really get to tell the stories of people and pull your readers into that world and to make them feel some sympathy for people who they may not have felt sympathy for before, to sort of humanize the face of some things. And I don't ever sort of start saying to myself, "Oh, I'm going to write about race and class in Memphis, Tennessee." But that's not my starting point. My starting point is there's this young kid who, you know, is homeless. He's got no parents. He's got no people looking out for him. And he's trying to stay out of the drug trade. And this is Memphis. So one path is to be a musician. So what are the stresses on him? Well, he's got some friends, but his friends aren't so disciplined. His friends aren't quite as good as he is. But because of the environment, you have to be almost superhuman to resist. The only way that you can really sustainably make a living in some of these areas. So, you know, part of it is to create sympathetic characters who you really feel for, and that's the goal. I mean, I think the most successful fiction in this kind of category, crime fiction, you've got to have those characters be characters that you're identifying with in some respect, even the bad guys, because you know, it might be fun to write this sort of you know, the cackling villain who rubs his hands together, but it's not totally realistic, right? Even people who are villains are really the heroes of their own stories. So to show sort of the point of view of someone who is really not a good person, but who has his reasons or her reasons for acting the way he or she does, you know, that is so much of the fun for me. And I think that's part of what makes these stories stand out and why the series has gained so much traction so quickly, because the characters really are all alive. I don't really like to write flat characters. I want these characters all to just be jumping off the page. Well, almost especially the bad guys. You've got to write a compelling bad guy.
Right.
And one way to do that is to get inside their head and to see how they see themselves.
Your writing career really launched when in 2006 you won the short story contest in the Seattle Review for your story At the Laundromat. In writing short fiction versus writing novels and a long-running novel series now, do you see the creative process in writing short fiction versus what you do mostly now? Do you approach those differently, and do you feel like writing short fiction equipped you in any way to do what you do now?
Well, short fiction absolutely equipped me to write long fiction. You know, I think you really learn how to develop a scene, how to develop a character in sort of quick strokes when you're working with short fiction, you know, something that's, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 words. And it's a good, for me, it really, it's almost an exercise to write short fiction, because I like short fiction, but it's not my go-to. You know, when I want to lay down on the couch for an afternoon, I don't lay down with a book of short stories. I lay down with a novel.
Right.
Because I want to get lost in a long form story. So writing short fiction is actually really, really difficult. And it's a great way, because you can fail quickly and you can iterate quickly. You can try an idea and you know, you're out a couple of days or a couple of weeks, if it doesn't pan out. Whereas if a couple of weeks, I am just starting to figure out, you know, what's going to happen with a novel. And you can be 6 months in and say to yourself, holy crap, this is just not going anywhere. Light It Up, my previous book, was actually, I had spent 4 months trying to get a book started that was a very different book. And I wrote the same 10,000 words over and over and over again.
Oh, I've been there.
And it's a horrible feeling. And
soul crushing.
And when you're, it's really quite bad. But with short fiction, you have that, you know, what's the Silicon Valley mantra is to fail fast. You know, with short fiction, it's easier to screw up. When you're writing long fiction, it's an investment. So, and I think there's a lot to be learned, but because I write series fiction now, it's harder for me to get back into short fiction, because I have this developed world that's still developing, and it's hard to kind of pull myself out of that and develop something different.
Well, Nick, I absolutely love what you're doing with your character Peter Ash, and with the story that keeps bringing us more and more. If the new book is Tear It Down, and when people are hearing this, it's available everywhere. Any way that you read hardback, audiobook, Kindle, however you consume books, it's available everywhere now. There's links to it in the show notes at hankgarner.com. Nick, I am a subscriber to your newsletter, and you write some of the best newsletters that are give us a glimpse into kind of what your daily process is, or when you've got a new book coming out, or you know, maybe some things that were going on in your mind that brought the story out. And I love reading them. Where can people find you online and subscribe to your newsletter and maybe follow you you know, as the story progresses?
Well, I'm glad you like my newsletter. It's fun to write these little, I mean, they're short little bits, but it's fun to sort of say, here's what's happening right now. And you can sign up on my website, nickpetrie.com. Find me on Facebook. I think you can sign up through Facebook as well. Twitter, all that stuff. I tend to do a lot more newsletter stuff and social media, you know, in the month before the book comes up. And it's going to, you know, fade away a little bit again, as I get back into working on what I'm working on now. But that's the way to find me. And you know, there's all sorts of back stuff you can find. And there are a couple of articles I've written on my website as well. I love it when readers reach out to me. I have sort of some ongoing conversations on social media with more than a few people, especially veterans. If any veterans are listening who want to talk about their experience, or who think there's something that I got right, or more importantly, something I got wrong, I'd love to have that conversation.
Excellent. Nick, we're going to send everybody to pick up their copy of Tear It Down, the latest Peter Ash novel. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, buddy. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Oh, thanks so much, Hank. I really appreciate it. And, you know, I'm going to be in Oxford on the 23rd at Square Books. So that's maybe not quite so far from you as Memphis.
That's,
so maybe I'd get to meet you in person.
We need to make that happen. I'm going to put that on the calendar. That sounds like a great thing.
Well, I know everybody's got kids and yep. Work and everything else, so it's a big ask. But I'd love to see you at 5 o'clock at Square Books.
That sounds great. I'll put a link also to your book tour with all your dates in there. I think people would appreciate seeing that.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Hello, young one. What ghoulish tale of horror shall we explore tonight? Shall we watch The Creepshow? The Nightmare on Elm Street? Child of the Night, give me your answer.
Which one would Mom kill us for watching? Said Buddy. Dad grinned and his eyes grew wide.
Which do you think, Child of the Jackal?
The Omen!
And we might have time for Omen too, if we hurry. She'll be home by 11.
I'll be back. Buddy ran to his room. He stripped down to his Yoda underwear and fished in the closet. 2 minutes later, he snuck back into the living room wearing his skeleton costume from last Halloween. He crept up behind his dad, who was queuing the movie. But David Rittermeier was too clever for that. He spun around at the last moment and bared fang teeth torn from paper plates, drawing a yip of surprise and a cry of, "No fair!" Daddy kicked off his Reeboks, plopped his smelly gym socks on the coffee table, another thing that Mom would hate, and killed the lights. The scary intro music began. The screen showed the silhouette of a boy, about Buddy's age. His shadow was a long, creepy cross. The Antichrist, the son of the devil. Born of a jackal on a night of astrological portent, destined to bring about the end times and the final battle of good versus evil. Buddy sipped sun-kissed and scooted up next to his dad. As the movie got scarier, he slipped an arm through his father's and cupped his big bicep. Buddy could feel his father's pulse. Dads get scared, too. They flinched together, shouted together, pointed at the screen and covered their faces together. Buddy pressed his eyes to Daddy's shoulder just before the on-screen maid shouted, "It's all for you, Damien!" and dove from the roof, hanging herself. Buddy knew which parts he was old enough to watch and which parts he wasn't. He trusted his dad to let him know when to look again. Occasionally, his dad tricked him into peeking too soon, but that was part of the fun. They kicked their feet at the screen and shouted, "Look up! Look up! Oh, idiot! Don't get yourself killed!" At the climax, the hero of the movie, Mr. Thorne, discovered a birthmark of 3 sixes on his son's head and dragged the little Antichrist to the altar of the church, determined to spear his son with holy daggers and end evil forever. After it was over, the Rittermeier men sat silently through the credits. David put an arm around his son and ran his fingers through Buddy's hair. He wasn't searching for devil marks. He knew there weren't any. And Buddy was certain there were no daggers in his father's hand, either. Those things were just make-believe. Real fathers and sons don't do bad things to each other. They were queuing up Omen 2 when the power went out.
"No," Buddy whined. "Not on movie night."
Daddy went to the window. "It's the whole block. Sorry, Damien. How about, Scary Blackout? Go get the Ouija board out of the guest room closet."
"Cool. And candles."
Buddy found the Ouija board, hidden under old clothes. When he shut the sliding door again, the sight of a monster startled him, and he let out an involuntary, "Huh!" sound. It was his own skeleton-bodied reflection in the mirrored closet door. He stared at it. He liked the effect of moonlight on his cheeks. Spectral, haunted, his eyes big and white. He clacked his teeth at himself, picturing his own grinning skull under his child's flesh, and gave an evil laugh. He was answered by a scream. A woman's scream. High-pitched and far away. One of the neighbors? Buddy dropped the Ouija board into a patch of moonlight and sat with it.
"What's going on?"
he whispered, his fingers on the heart-shaped wood planchette.
A revolutionary quantum teleportation device promises to bring humanity one step closer to the stars until it fails spectacularly. The Translocator from M.G. Herron, available now on audible.com. Go to mgherron.com/ASP. Archaeologist Eliana Fisk is ripped from Earth while the whole world watches. She lands on a strange new world inhabited by a lost tribe of ancient Mayans, meeting them, getting first-hand exposure to age-old customs and rituals. It seems like an archaeologist's dream. But what if the rituals have a darker meaning? What if the god these people pray to is no god at all? And how in the world will she ever get back home? Thus begins a pulse-pounding race against time that hurls Eliana into a great unknown, revealing ancient technologies and marvelous mysteries more outlandish than she ever imagined. The Translocator is an action-packed sci-fi thriller perfect for fans of Stargate, The Atlantis Gene, and other archaeology-inspired science fiction adventures. Pick it up today. Go to mgherron.com/ASP. That's mgherron.com/ASP. The Translocator by M.G. Herron.